Hi, it's Aaron from Gangland Wire. I've got a special for you, wiretappers. You need to go to JurassicJerkyLLC.com if you love beef jerky. High-protein meat snacks for you at a discount because you're a wiretapper. Just go on over to JurassicJerkyLLC.com, put in the promo code GANG10, and you're going to receive 10% off your next purchase.
Hi, my name is Jason Lopes. I live in Scotts Valley, and I love listening to Gangland Wire on my app, Podcast Addict. It's awesome. Have a great time. I love listening to any mob stories, any crime like that these guys put on. You guys are great. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work. Have a great day.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, all you wiretappers out there. We're back here. The Ice House Building, Classic Ice House Building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Aaron's over there frantically working on some kind of piece of equipment. I'm not sure what it is, but I got a message from Dean from Ireland, one of our Irish fans over there, and he asked if we'd do something about the Irish mobs in the United States. And I thought, well, you know, I read a book called The Westies a few years ago, and it was fascinating. And that was a little more modern. We're going to go all the way back to Oney Madden, who was kind of the first well-known Irish mob boss in New York City. And this is all going to be about New York City. You know, they started the Irish historically moved into what's known as the Hell's Kitchen area of New York City. And that's just, it's on the west side of Midtown Manhattan, west of Broadway, over to the Hudson River. And I think it started farther down, maybe around, down by Battery Park and moved on north up to 59th Street. It's west of the Theater District, 42nd Street, if you've been down there and in that area.
Are you saying, but that was like in the mid-1850s?
It was really mainly after the Civil War. Really, a lot of Irish immigrants came over during and after the Civil War. There were some before. But after the Civil War and during the Civil War, they started flogging in. There was a famine in Ireland, I believe, during that time. And this was referred to as a Five Points area back then. I'm not sure what the Five Points were. I'd have to look that. I didn't look that one up.
Is that maybe because there was like streets that all came together?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
Five Points.
New York City and Manhattan was totally different in 1870 and 1860 and 1880 than it is now, sure.
So. I don't think that's considered Hell's Kitchen anymore, is it?
No, they call it Clinton Place, I understand, or Clinton, because Governor Clinton, one of the early governors of New York State, but they changed it from Hell's Kitchen to Clinton. Martin Scorsese produced a film about this time in this area called The Gangs of New York. It tells the story of the early Irish gangs fighting Protestant gangs and their connections to Boss Tweed of New York City politics. The Italians were not really here yet. The Irish were here first. They started moving into the larger culture, shall we say, getting government jobs and fomenting their own creating their own businesses, and they had their gangs, and there were Protestant gangs already here. Everybody kind of lined up along Catholic and Protestant back in those days, too. It's kind of like what happened in Kansas City. It just happened later in Kansas City because we're so much farther west. But by, 1915 or 1920, we had the Pendergast faction, who were Irish, and they ran all the West Bottoms, and they had Irish criminals working for them. But they pretty quickly, Italians had moved in, and they Pendergast pretty quickly formed a you know, kind of a criminal and political connection with the Italian gangsters to get votes out of the North End and help get muscle for, you know, make sure the elections went right. And there was a few Irish mobsters. We never really created, or we never really had a, what we call a true Irish kind of criminal gang that arose up that anybody really knows anything about. It's kind of interesting, Aaron, the name Hell's Kitchen. There's several kind of older, there are several myths about how this place got the name Hell's Kitchen. Probably the one that I liked the best and seemed the most kind of logical was during this time, there was a couple of cops, and all the cops would have been Protestants at that point in time, and they were watching a big fight or even a small riot between some rival Irish gangs, and one said, you know, this place is like hell. And the other cop, the older cop, said, no, this place is so hot it's more like Hell's Kitchen. So that's one of the stories on how it got the name of Hell's Kitchen. It's the area, if you've ever been to Manhattan or you've seen the images and movies and stuff, older movies especially, the tenement buildings that have the up off the street that had the fire escapes and the iron, wrought iron and iron ladders and little landings at each window and then go up to the next floor and the next floor. Well, that's kind of a prominent architectural kind of...
The brownstones?
Well, you don't call those brownstones. They're brick buildings. Brownstone's a little different. These are like 3 and 4 story, and they have prominent...
those metal fire escapes on the sides.
Metal fire escapes on the sides, on the street side that go straight up the side of the building. That's kind of the most distinctive architectural...
Feature,
yeah, good word. Architectural feature to identify Hell's Kitchens. There's other places, but they're pretty. There'll be blocks and blocks of them over on the kind of just south of what we call the Upper West Side now. It's all changed. That's all very expensive now. This was a cheap place to live back then. So I said we're going to talk about Oney Madden. A lot of people have heard of Oney Madden. He became a pretty famous Irish gangster. His mother was an Irish woman named Mary Madden. She came over alone in 1901. She had a drunken, petty criminal of a husband named Francis. And she left Francis and both of her sons in England. And they'd already farmed the boys out to some kind of... orphan's home, and dad wasn't taking care of business. And by 1902, she was over here a year, and she found, you know, other Irish people to help her find jobs, and she got going pretty quick. And in a couple of years, or in a year, 1902, she brought her two sons, Oney and Martin Madden, over. Their father never made it to the United States. He's kind of lost to history. They of course, found a home in the long-established, by this point in time, in 1902, Irish community in Hell's Kitchen or Five Points, and this will shape Oney Madden's life permanently. He became part of this community quickly and had a lot of friends. It gave him a reliable and loyal network among the thousands of other Irish immigrant families. His first gang, by the time he was 12 years old, he joined the Gopher Gang, which was pretty big, and there's like several hundred boys in this Gopher Gang, and they fought other gangs, and they he was described, Oney Madden was not a big guy. He was described as a banny little rooster from hell, because he was a fierce fighter, and he was known for his skill with a lead pipe and a gun. They had fights with their main rival was the Hudson Dusters.
At 12 years old?
They grew up fast. You grew up fast in that time. So the next several years, you know, from 12 until he was 18, and he was in this gang and was a criminal and kind of rose to the top of it. He gained the nickname The Killer. He once gunned down an Italian gang member in the streets, and after which he shouted, "I'm Oney Madden, 10th Avenue." And you know, despite he did this right in the middle of the street, in the middle of the day, It was a totally public crime. No witnesses ever came forward to link him to the crime, but his reputation was solidified as the killer from then on. About 1910, he was 18 years old. He was one of the more prominent members of the Gophers gang. He'd already been suspected in the deaths of five rival gang members. He was a leader of one of three factions in the Gophers. It was reported that he was earning as much as $200 a day, and that would be about like $2,000 a day today when he was 18 years old. And this was from the Gophers' criminal activities. They had protection rackets. You know, in the movies where they go around, the kids go around to the candy stores, the corner stores, and say, you know, you probably need a little protection. You don't want any of these other kids coming around here breaking out your windows or burning your store down. And so, you know, they give them so much money a week, and that, you know, that was their deal, was they provided protection for all the local businessmen. Oney Madden had, what's kind of interesting about him, he had movie star looks. And by the time he's in his early 20s, he has quite a little bit of money. He became, and some people would call him the Prince of Hell's Kitchen. He was often accompanied by beautiful women. And he was violent. He had one chink in his armor, shall we say. He was violently jealous over his women. He once shot and killed a store clerk named William Henshaw just because a guy asked one of Oney Madden's girls out. He ran into her on board of a trolley and asked her out, and she went back and told Oney, "I think she was one of these gals that likes to play one guy off against the other, don't you, Aaron?"
Well, I wonder how many times she could do that before he finally just shoots her.
She probably didn't do that again after he killed that guy.
Or after that came out, no one was like, "I'm not going out with her."
Henshaw survived that attack, actually, initially. Jeez. But he later died. And the police, he named him, but then the police arrested him, and they had a lot of witnesses, but when it came time to go to trial, they dismissed the case because there's no corroborating witnesses to come forward. So he continually would do these kinds of crimes down in Hell's Kitchen where they're all Irish people, so nobody's going to testify against each other.
Wait a second. The guy that got shot said, "This is the guy that shot me."
Right.
Isn't that a first-hand account?
Yeah, it is. But you need to have some other witnesses.
You need someone to corroborate.
Well, he died. He died before they had time to go to trial. Now, it would be a deathbed statement, which would probably be entered as evidence.
If no one else came forward to say, "Well, yeah, I saw the guy get shot."
If you got other witnesses and they won't corroborate it, yeah. Then anyhow, I mean, there probably was a little payoff going on too. You know, this is not 2015 squeaky clean county courts, even in the big cities like New York. You can't get away with that stuff anymore, but back then you could.
Well, and it's probably people that are riding the trolley on a daily basis.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, living in the neighborhood.
Yep, that's how it goes, isn't it? It's the same way. I mean, in any ghetto, shall we say, today, you know, stitches get snitches and all that, and the police mm-hmm. are always complaining how nobody will come forward. It's the same deal.
Snitches get stitches.
Yeah, it's the same deal as it was back then. Only it was Irish. We won't talk about what it is today because we all know we don't want to get involved in any political discussions here. Oney Madden was wanting to expand his territory and the Gophers territory and his faction of the Gophers territory, and particularly into the Hudson Dusters. They laid an ambush for him, and he shot him 11 times on 52nd Street outside of a dance hall. This was in 1912, so he would have been about 20. He survived the attack, but he refused to identify his attackers. When police asked him, he said, nothing doing. My boys will get them for me. It's nobody's business but mine who put these slugs in me. I can just hear this, you know, cocky little, I wish I could do an Irish brogue. We need Alex on here to do an Irish brogue for us. Within a week after Oney was out of the hospital, several members of the Hudson Dusters had been killed.
I wonder who was the actors in Gangs of New York. Maybe he could watch the movie and...
Yeah, I don't know. I
do
tried
some
to,
lines.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hoo-ah!
Yeah, he could no. He could look, do that and get some lines out of that.
Some Al Pacino.
Put on a little skit. Oney Madden. Nothing doing. The boys will get him. Anyhow, 1914, a couple years later, he got in a dispute with a guy named Little Patsy Doyle, who was a prominent member of the Dusters. And this was, again, over a woman, Freda Horner. And in a breach of gangland, Irish gangland ethics, Doyle informed the police about Oney Madden and his operations. So Madden, in retaliation, arranged for his murder. Madden sent a message to Doyle through another girlfriend and gal named Margaret Everdeen to ask Doyle to meet Madden to hash out a peace agreement. Well, they set this up at a bar there in Hell's Kitchen, and Doyle got there first, November 28, 1914. Madden was lying in wait, and he ambushed Doyle and killed him. Now, the woman was questioned. The police were on to him for this, and the woman was questioned. They knew she had set this deal up, and she confessed. She confessed to her role in the killing, and she named Oney Madden. They probably got her out of New York pretty quick. He would be sentenced to 20 years in Sing Sing for this crime. That's in 1914. He served 9 years. He comes back out in 1923, and this is right after the start of Prohibition. Prohibition started in 1920. A lot of things had changed. His old gopher gang had broken up, and many members of the faction that he was most connected to and closest to, that he had led at one time, were either in the joint or they were working for other bootlegging gangs, because this was the deal. That was the time when you can make money. And everything changed from the time he went in the joint till he came out.
Well, there was a world war, so I'm surprised they didn't give him an opportunity to serve for his country.
I think
they do that?
They do that, but usually for things like drunken public and malicious destruction of property.
Not murder.
I had a relative that ended up in Vietnam getting out of a malicious destruction of property back in 1969 or 68, so... But usually not for murder, and that's only in the movies that they put up what's the movie with Lee Marvin? They get the guys out of the penitentiary, out of the joint, all these killers. And
Magnificent
stuff.
Seven.
No, that was in Mexico. Oh God, what is that movie? Somebody out there, help us! send us what that movie is with Lee Marvin. And I've just had a senior moment here, I guess. Well, you know, Oney gets out, everything's changed, and everybody's organized up into bootlegging gangs because there's so much money to be made here. And it's much easier money than going around threatening your neighbor who owns a store and that kind of stuff. He was given a job. He got a job by a former member of his own street gang, a guy named Larry Fay. Larry Fay had a taxicab company in Manhattan. He used it as a cover for his bootlegging activities, and he was kind of a weak guy. He was not a real strong guy like Oney Madden with that killer reputation, and he was still known as the killer. And he needed somebody like Madden to maintain control of his territory. Gave him a gang of strong-arm guys to work under Madden to help make sure that his cab stands were protected, and which were part of the booze delivery system. Oney was a quick study, and he started learning about the business, and he quickly moved on to form his own organization, going to competition. Now, here's a kind of interesting little tidbit I did not know before. Oney Madden, during this time, employed a young friend from Hell's Kitchen as his personal driver, and that driver was George Raft, who later went on to become a film star. George Raft, you remember George Raft? He was known for portraying really authentic portrayals of mafia and gang kind of professional criminals. He was a guy that they used to do a thing where he'd stand leaning up against a wall flipping a coin, like a silver dollar, and just flipping it up and catching it, flipping it up and catching it as he was watching somebody.
Probably because he'd seen somebody do that before.
probably.
He was a method actor.
He probably had seen somebody really do that before on the streets.
Much like any of the gang, at least in some of the stuff we've talked about, oftentimes the driver moves up to become the boss.
Yeah. Well, this driver moved out to Hollywood to become a film star. Oney Madden became really heavily involved in bootlegging, and he established his territory became the entire area of Hell's Kitchen. 1924, the Madden gang started hijacking another liquor shipments from another Irish bootlegger, Big Bill Dwyer. Dwyer was a smart cookie, though. Rather than go to war with Madden, he took him on as a partner, and so they could double the size of their territory and be even stronger. And he needed Dwyer, again, he was like Mr. Fay. He needed somebody with Madden's reputation to beef up all the enforcement of his operation. You gotta enforce stuff. You got bootleg. You got other people, speakeasies that'll steal from you, or your own employees will set up one of your loads to be ripped off, or some other rival gang will come in and steal a load of booze from you when you're delivering.
Losing some of your product to dirty cops.
And dirty cops, yeah. Well, you just pay them off, I think, back then. Madden and starts, only Madden then, he starts moving on up, and you know, he's got a lot more money, and he throws in with a former rival of his, and he keeps throwing in with these former rivals and creating, you know, more, and creating, God, I can't even think of it.
A larger organized gang.
Yeah. He keeps, only Madden throws in with a former gang rival and makes him into a partner to create, and he keeps, he's about the third time he's done that to create a larger, more profitable organization. This was a guy named George Demands. They called him Big Frenchy, I guess because that last name is French. I would have to assume that Demands, I bet he was Irish that had a French name. But anyhow, Big Frenchy, and they opened a whole bunch of speakeasies and nightclubs, some of the flashiest speakeasies and nightclubs of the time. The one that most of us have heard of is the legendary Cotton Club in Harlem. This really kind of became like the John Gotti of the West Side back then. He was the you know, the mob guy to the stars. Nightclub patrons would flood up into Harlem from downtown Manhattan and catch in the Cotton Club, and they had performers like Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Lena Horne, Bill Bojangles Robinson, and the Nicholas Brothers. I think they were tap dancers. The rest of them I'd heard of. Nicholas Brothers I hadn't heard of. They also, there was a really exclusive downtown Manhattan club called the Stork Club, and they muscled their way into a piece of that. That was where, if you ever heard of Walter Winchell, he was a real influential gossip columnist at the time. He held court, and anybody who wanted to be seen or be seen would go to the Stork Club, and here it was, owned by this Irish mobster. He became a celebrity nightclub owner, and he had ownership in more than 20 clubs, and he became really well known, and he was glamorized and was romanticized for his Prohibition era. He was romanticized for his Prohibition era activities. He also gained a lot of recognition for his revenge tactics. You don't want to cross Oney Madden, the killer, and he created a whole stable of corrupt police and politicians, and he paid them off. He's kind of your all-around mafia gangster, only he wasn't the Irish mafia. He was the, he wasn't the Italian mafia, the Cosa Nostra. He was the Irish mafia. They don't have any cool little foreign words like that for their organization. They eventually will become known as the Westies. Well, by the 1931, Prohibition's almost over, and he sees that's coming, and he got out of bootlegging. Got out of the clubs, a little bit out of the clubs because he didn't need so many of them, but he got into professional boxing. Now, I've always heard back in those days that the mob pretty well controlled boxing. Boxing was a much bigger deal.
Back in the 30s.
Back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. Really, it fell out of favor by the 60s to the 70s. It was almost totally out of favor, it seemed like, except for Muhammad Ali. But back then, boxing was huge. And they had, you know, that's when Max Baer was, the German fighter, was the world champion.
You mean from Beverly Hillbillies?
Yeah, no, no.
He never looked that old.
Not Jethro D. Bodine.
That was Max Baer.
I know. I always laugh when I saw that. But he controlled people like that. Another guy, Primo Canera, I don't know him, but he was a pretty big-time fighter, with Canera, he was a little bit corrupt, and Madden started arranging fixed fights for Canera, And eventually, he was able to win the World Heavyweight Championship in 1933. And you know, on the side, they were betting huge sums of money through bookies on these boxing matches. Because I got a feeling that boxing is, for a bookie, boxing's a little bit like any other sporting competition. You take in so much money on one person, you take in so much money on the other person, and you try to balance the books, and then the losers pay you a 10%, what they call vigorish. And so the bookie doesn't really make any money off the gambling. They make the money off the vigorish. Now, if you know who's going to win, then you go in and you put straw people, you put in a whole bunch of money on Carnera, then you're going to win all your bets, and you're going to make even more than what the vigorish would be when you're just taking the 10% vig. Reporters got suspicious about these fixed fights and started exposing Madden, and he ended up quitting fixing the fights for Carnera. And eventually in 1934, June 14th, 1934, Max Baer fought him, and that's when he won the World Heavyweight Championship. Now, I think he'll go on to lose that to Joe Louis late in his career, but I'm not sure on that. Somebody out there, one of you guys can correct me on that. 1932, Oney Madden was involved in the murder of Vincent Mad Dog Call, who had been extorting money from different mobsters in New York, and including demands in Madden. I guess Oney couldn't take it anymore. He'd been arrested for a parole violation from his old case, and he was getting, the police were paying a lot more attention to him and harassing him, and probably because the Italian mafia families, they have made so much money and achieved so much power, and there's they're probably paying off the police to go after Oney and telling him, don't take money from him, you go get him, and because they want to get him out. And so he finally, he just left New York City in 1935. Now, here's what's interesting, and I didn't know this before. He settles in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
That's a pretty quiet little town, isn't it?
300 miles south of Kansas City here. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Hot Springs, Arkansas, if you remember, Frank Nash, on his he was wanted for bank robbery, and the feds went to Hot Springs and found him down there and arrested him and brought him up to Union Station when they had the Union Station massacre.
And somebody gave him a tip that he was there.
Right. Now, see, Hot Springs was known to be wide open to mobsters on the run. It was a city with a corrupt police force and corrupt city officials, and they overlooked most everything within reason. And they certainly overlooked illegal casino gambling, and there was a well-known racetrack that's still operating down there. I guess it's just called Hot Springs, or is it Arlington? No, Arlington's a hotel, but there was a well-known racetrack, so there was a lot of gambling, a lot of illegal gambling down there, nightclubs. He opened a nightclub called the Southern Club, and it became a real popular night spot for vacationing mobsters out of New York. Lucky Luciano was arrested there in 1935. But Oney seemed to kind of go straight during this time. I don't know how much of this gambling he was involved in. There were several people involved in. You know, even up until, say, the 60s, I remember I knew a guy. He was a little bit older than me when I was in high school. He was in his 20s, and he was a huge gambler. They were always around in rural areas. They'll have crap games in houses that will maybe be thousands of dollars will trade hands at these crap games. I actually went to a few of them, just watched. I wasn't much of a gambler, didn't have any money anyhow. But this guy I knew, who was 4 or 5 years older than me, he did have some money, and he loved to gamble. And he told me, he said, you know, he was trying to get me to go down there with him. He said, let's go down to Hot Springs. And he said, that's the point in time when only Las Vegas had legalized gambling. And it wasn't really very well known in, say, 1964, 63. He knew about Hot Springs, and he wanted to go down to Hot Springs and gamble because you could gamble down there. He said it's wide open down there. Now, I never did it, and I don't know if he ever did or not, but that's how long it lasted. It didn't really change until, the middle to early 1970s, probably the early 1970s when it finally changed.
So maybe he was just down there, hit a nice club, and running some—
I think
some
he did.
Gambling rackets.
He probably had something to do with the gambling rackets because he had so much knowledge in it,
and he had the reputation that no one was going to mess with it.
Yeah, really. He became a naturalized U.S. citizen. If you remember, he came over here as a child from Ireland, and probably never hardly went to school. I have to wonder how he passed that test. We have to assume that he must have studied real hard, because I know it's a hard test to pass. But he became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 1943. You know, he might have done something for the Army, too, to get that. If you do certain things for the Army, they can pull some strings there. He married the daughter of the city postmaster, and he lived in Hot Springs until his death in 1965. Now the
so wait a second. So he leaves New York. I mean, he was there, and certainly the Italian mob was there in the 20s and into the 30s. I would think they were deep into bootlegging, so that would create a lot of conflict with these Irish gangs.
That's why he left town.
He leaves town, and still there's other Irish gangs there.
Yeah, they left. There was always some there, but the La Cosa Nostra really was becoming the most powerful organized crime families in Manhattan or New York City, in the New York City area during this time. They didn't really resist the La Cosa Nostra family. Actually, what they really did more was start throwing in with them as kind of underlings. You know, the war comes along in 1940s, kind of all bets are off. And then by the 1950s, there was an Irish guy named Hugh Mulligan, who was known as the boss in Hell's Kitchen and ran the gambling rackets, but he would have probably been paying some tribute to one or more, at least one of the La Cosa Nostra mafia families. He had a couple of proteges, and the two most famous proteges were Jimmy Burke and Mickey Spillane. Now, Jimmy Burke, Jimmy the Gent, he would go on to work with the Lucchese family. He led a hijacking crew working for the underboss. I think it was the underboss, Paul Vario. And he would eventually be made famous by one of his former gang members, Henry Hill. If you remember the Scorsese film Goodfellas, Jimmy the Gent was played by Robert De Niro.
Well, and Jimmy Burke was involved in the Lufthansa heist.
The Lufthansa heist. I guess I just didn't say that because I figured everybody would know that, but I'm glad you said that. Yeah, they're involved in that Lufthansa heist. And if you've seen the movie Goodfellas or read the book, that's Jimmy the Gent was Robert De Niro. But the other one one of his other proteges stayed with the Irish mobs on the west side and did not move in with the Italians like Jimmy the Gent then, or Jimmy Burke. And that was Michael J. Spillane, or Mickey Spillane. Now, he's not, you ever heard of Mickey Spillane, the private eye? This is not Mickey Spillane, the private eye. It is a pretty cool name for a mobster or a private eye. He stayed true to his Irish roots, and he became boss of the organization that during this time became known as the Westies. Now, he was born in 1933, so he was like the next generation that came along after Oney Madden. He was often called, Mickey Spillane was often called the last of the gentleman gangsters because he had a certain style of doing things that was much more businesslike and less violent than the mob members of the West Side or the Westies that would succeed him after he was gone. He had movie star good looks. He started as a numbers runner for various organized crime figures in Hell's Kitchen like Hugh Mulligan. He took over all the bookmaking and loan shark rackets left him by Huey Mulligan. He kind of moved into that in 1960. He moved into the kind of the boss of the Irish mobs. But he was a little bit different than that. He wasn't exactly directly politically active, but he married Maureen McManus. She was the daughter of the Democratic district leader Eugene McManus. And Mickey was known to do things like hand out turkeys to poor families on Thanksgiving or visit elderly widows in the neighborhood. And he had these good political connections, and he was really a neighborhood guy. During this time, the Irish mob or the Italian mobsters really dominated all organized crime, but they stayed out of Hell's Kitchen during this time. And Mickey Spillane, he just couldn't leave well enough alone. He may have been a gentleman gangster for other Irish people, but he would kidnap members of the Italian mafia and ransom them back for money.
As a way to raise money for his own operation?
Right, right. He did gambling and loan sharking. He would not allow them to get involved in drugs. Now, Mickey Spillane, Italians kind of stayed away, but he would poke them every once in a while by kidnapping them and ransoming them for money. And in the end, it was his inability to do business with on an equal basis or unequal basis, do business with the Italian mobsters that led to his downfall. In the 1960s, there's a big convention center that's pretty well known that was being planned to be the. There was this convention center was in the planning works, was in the planning stages to be built. It was the Jacob K. Javits Convention Center, and it's huge. It was going to be built on the west side, and Madison Square Garden was going to be part of it. And you had the waterfront, and the unions were all generating a lot of money enormous amounts of money for Mickey Spillane. And the Italian mobs were desperate for a piece of this action, and he would not allow them to participate. And that's when the New York Irish-Italian mob war began.
Was part of that because of their wanting the contracts for right. the construction?
Right. Construction contracts, unions, union activity, kickbacks, all kinds of other fees that are associated with running a large convention center. Like they hire a particular union. If you're going to move in and set up for a trade show, you have to use the stagehands, for example.
Yeah, you have to use approved union people. It can be incredibly expensive just to do a load-in.
Right.
And then you got to get the stuff out.
And so, the Italians want a little piece of that action. They just add a little bit on top of it for them, and they wanted a piece of the construction contract.
But it was Spillane's territory,
and he was not allowing them to have anything to do with it at all. They weren't making any money at all, and they were they greatly outnumbered the members of the Irish mob, the Westies that Mickey Spillane was in charge of. But he kept them out for quite a while. They were pretty frustrated. It was a Genovese family. Was the main one that wanted a piece of this action. They felt like that was their territory. They ended up hiring a Irish hitman, Irish-American hitman named Joseph Mad Dog Sullivan. They kind of liked that Mad Dog nickname.
Moniker,
Mad Dog Call, and there's Mad Dog Sullivan. Anyhow, they hired him to assassinate three of Spillane's lieutenants, Tom Devaney and Eddie the Butcher Kaminsky and Tom the Greek Capatos. So they had some Greek and sounds like Polish or other Eastern European people involved with their organization, but no Italians.
They just kind of got everybody else that wasn't Irish, maybe. Yeah. That didn't want to be Italian.
And I think that's what they did.
And the Italians, although they did use some other ethnic groups,
they mainly kept it to themselves.
Yeah.
Henry Hill was half Italian,
They were all Peckerwoods.
These guys are all Peckerwoods. Irishmen are Peckerwoods, and Greeks are not really Peckerwoods, but they're Greeks. And Eastern yeah. Europeans are Russians, and the Russian mobs are a whole different ballgame for the Italian mobs.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if your nickname is the Butcher or not.
No, they don't care. Well, by the mid-1970s, Mickey Spillane had moved his family out of Hell's Kitchen, out into Queens, because there were so many threats of retaliation against him, and he was afraid that somebody might do something to his children. And also during the 60s, there was a young Irish-American gangster named Jimmy Coonan, and he wanted to do something to Spillane. He really wanted to take over his territory, and he ended up murdering a Spillane underling. But Coonan was sent to prison in 1967. Mickey Spillane had kidnapped Jimmy Coonan's father when Coonan was a kid and held him for ransom and got some money out of the deal. And he also wanted to avenge that. So when Coonan was released from prison for whatever this other crime was in 1967, he realized he couldn't do this alone, and he reached out to the Gambino crime family through a new up-and-coming young mobster from Brooklyn named Roy DeMeo, who was a stone killer himself. And this would kind of mark the beginning of the end of the Irish mob, because Coonan would eventually work just directly for the Gambinos. May 13th, 1977, Mickey Spillane is watching TV with his three sons when his phone rang. He answers, has a little short conversation, doesn't say anything to the boys, sits back down with the boys, and a little bit later, they hear a car horn honk outside. Mickey just told the boys that he had to run out in front and talk to somebody, so obviously this telephone call was from somebody he trusted and said, hey, I want to tell you, I got something for you. I want to tell you something. I'll be out in front in just a little bit. He left, went out front, and he never came back. He'll find out later that there was a car idling out in front of his apartment building, and as he walked outside of his apartment, somebody fired three or four shots outside out from the inside of that car and killed Mickey Spillane. Now, it was rumored at the time this Roy DeMeo was responsible for this murder, and he had a couple guys, they called them the Gemini twins, I think, and I can't remember their names now, were stone killers, and they operated out of the Gemini Lounge. But anyhow, I think they called these two guys the Gemini twins. I'll have to get into that with the Roy DeMeo story.
But that seems odd, because just because Spillane would be, like you said, someone calls him at home, so they have his number.
Sure.
And he's talking with him like he knows him and says he's going to go meet him out front, which, was he that good or close of an associate with DeMeo?
We don't know who called him. It wasn't Roy DeMeo that called him. It was somebody that he trusted that called him. It'd be like me calling you and say, hey, Aaron, I got something for you. I'm going to be by your house in about 15 or 20 minutes. Listen for the honk.
Yeah, and then I walk out and there's somebody else's car.
Well, it could even be my car, but somebody else might be in it. Anyhow, they're
hard to say what happened on the other side of that phone call conversation,
right, yeah,
that made the person call Spillane.
Well, it was probably somebody that wanted to be part of, somebody Jimmy Coonan knew. He probably wouldn't trust Jimmy Coonan, but it was probably somebody Coonan knew who was trusted by Spillane, who, you know, it would, whoever it was trusted by Spillane, or he had never walked out in front there.
Yeah, it seems odd a little bit to be like, well, I don't feel safe in Hell's Kitchen. Let me move to Queens.
Well, what do we know? We live in Kansas City.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just
it'd
saying.
Be like, I don't feel safe in West Plaza. Let me move up to Parkville or North Kansas City. Or
is it even that far?
It's not very far.
You know, the long arm of the La Cosa Nostra probably can go all the way to Queens.
Yeah. I'm not sure. The Spillane family, some of his descendants, probably these boys, they still own a bar in Hell's Kitchen. It's called Mickey Spillane's Hell's Kitchen. It's on 49th and 9th Avenue.
Man, there is an address for your app.
For somebody's mob tour app, anyhow. Next time, we're going to go on to Jimmy Coonan and the Jimmy Coonan era, because Jimmy Coonan will now take over the West Side and all the rackets on the West Side, although he will really just be, he'll be under the Italian mafia. He'll be under the Genovese gang. I'm not sure if Roy DeMeo was high. I don't think Roy DeMeo would have been like a boss over him, but he's the one that brought him in and probably set this whole deal up to get the Irish to just work with the La Cosa Nostra Mafia. But the violence and murder associated with the Coonan gang will probably be unparalleled in mob history, even more than maybe the Kill the Irishman mob war in Cleveland with Danny Green, and certainly more than the Spiro Savella war here in Kansas City. I can't think in Chicago. Seemed like they had kind of one war, but nothing like what happened in Ireland in Manhattan with the Westies and the Italians, and mainly the Westies just among themselves.
Well, so Jimmy Coonan, though, he aligns himself with the Gambino family or the Genovese?
Genovese, I believe. Yeah, the Gambino family.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was looking at your notes.
Roy DeMeo was a Gambino family member. See, we're kind of getting mixed up here, because it was a Genovese family that was one. They were really working together. They wanted control of the rackets around the Javits Convention Center.
In Madison Square Garden.
Now, then along comes Jimmy Coonan, and he somehow gets hooked up with Roy DeMay, all these things. You never know. Maybe he met him in the joint, or he met somebody who was real close to Roy DeMayo in the joint. Anyhow, he comes out of the joint, and he falls in with Roy DeMayo, who was with the Gambino crime family. But the Italians were all together against the Irish in many ways, because what they wanted was they wanted to get Mickey Spillane out of there and get somebody that they could control in, and that would be Jimmy Coonan.
Yeah, to take over all the operations.
All of it, and open up the convention center activities and all the different rackets associated with a big operation like that. If you've got a friend or a relative, a loved one, that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out to Amazon and buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. Hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it and watch the story of how turf wars over parking in Kansas City broke open a whole other story of skimming in Las Vegas. And then you need to share, subscribe, and support Gangland Wire, because we've got more great episodes than about anybody else out there, with 140 original free episodes. And we've got a few behind a paywall if you put a hit out on our donate button. And then remember, you need to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, get on your iPhone and take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And, of course, the latest and greatest from Gary Jenkins, Leaving Vegas.
Now, FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Available in paperback, but you want to get the Kindle, because then you've got hyperlinks and you can hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.